Let me speak to Felicity. Good morning, Felicity.
Good morning, Frank.
Felicity, you know about the issue that one of the issues that we've been talking about this morning, and to many people it is an absolute curse, the curse of anorexia. You know about it. Tell me your story, please.
Well, I've been struggling now with anorexia for about 8+ years. So I've been in and out of services and treatment for that time. And this year alone, I've had 20 hospital admissions to a general hospital with life-threatening complications arising from it. And I still have difficulty accessing services in Northern Ireland to get treatment.
When you do get the treatment, what does that involve?
It usually involves one-to-one sort of psychological care. Usually this works for some people. It doesn't work for everyone because they have a one-size-fits-all approach. In theory, with the care pathway, it's meant to be more holistic, but this exists really only on paper. In practice, it doesn't really exist. If you need to go inpatient, it's basically a case of weight restoration rather than therapeutic input, and there isn't enough support for the transition back out into the community, and there isn't support for friends and family as well.
I know you're studying this in great detail and you're writing your dissertation on anorexia, but just before I go to that element of it, could you explain to me and to people who'd be listening to the programme what it feels like to have that mental challenge? And indeed, do you accept that it is a mental challenge?
Yes, I would accept that it's a mental challenge, but it also has physical complications. It can feel very lonely and overwhelming, and food has kind of become part of my everyday life. The studies have shown that there's actual changes in the brain in relation to when you're eating or in issues around food. So it literally becomes sort of a mental torture continuously every single day. It's very difficult to find a way of putting it into words. I would kind of describe it almost as an abusive relationship. So in an abusive relationship, you know that the situation isn't right and your friends and family want you to get out of that situation. And every time I end up in hospital, I know that I need to get better. But each time the eating disorder then says to me, you won't end up in hospital again, it's okay. And I go back to the eating disorder to the dismay of my family. And I know that it's dangerous. I know that it's lethal, but there's that disconnect, much like in relation to a domestic violence situation.
My impression of anorexia is someone who doesn't eat what they need to stay healthy. And I know there's bulimia as well, where you're eating and then regurgitating your food. But I'm talking about my understanding of anorexia, and correct me, of course, if I'm wrong. I visualise a person who will not eat the required amount of food because for some reason they feel that the food is in some way an enemy of them, that they don't want the food, they feel the food is disgusting in some way. And I try to visualise how that would manifest itself with me, someone who's blessed with loving food. I visualise like onions or semolina. I'm not being flippant in any way. I'm listing things that I detest, and I'm thinking to myself, does all food seem like that to you?
Well, I actually have foods that I feel more comfortable with, but it is very different. When it comes to anorexia, there's actually two subtypes. So there's a restricting subtype and there's a purging subtype, which people sometimes mistake for bulimia. The idea is that you aren't actually having enough intake to stay or remain healthy. But I would be quite a lover of food. I love food like anyone else. I just can't quite manage to have the same relationship with it as other people do. But it's not as simple as necessarily being limited to, say, people have images of someone who just maybe eats an apple. I had a friend who also had an eating disorder, and people used to get on my back because I would sit down and I would have a salad, whereas she would have a packet of crisps and a bottle of Lucozade. Whereas I was maybe having the salad and maybe something very small for breakfast. That was all she was having within the day. But because it appeared to be a higher calorie type food content, people assumed that she was well because they saw that. So it can be very individual. The point being that there happens to be a difficult relationship with food, an uncomfortable relationship with food, and it can affect people of all weights.
Yeah, yes, but this is the bit I don't understand. Explain that to me. You say you like food, and if someone, you know, if you sat down in a restaurant with a pizza or whatever, and your friend was eating it, you're unlikely to eat a full slice. Is that right, or am I showing my ignorance here?
I actually would be unlikely to eat the pizza personally. I have found that when I go out to restaurants, I generally need to know what's on the menu in advance. And because when I read a menu, I don't necessarily see the food. I see the content of the food, and it reads very differently to me. And I get the same thing every single time when I'm out in a restaurant, because I know that I'm comfortable with that. And my friends are great around this issue. But
so it's the ingredients. It's the ingredients of the other foods that are putting you off.
It's the calorie content. I see, like, if I go down a shopping aisle and I see food and I can see one that's a lower calorie content, I'm more likely to take that than the one that's of the higher calorie content. It's not necessarily that I wouldn't eat that food. It has to be set within very strict sort of limitations that I personally feel comfortable with. And that can vary from person to person as to what they feel comfortable with.
And are you always afraid of putting on weight, always afraid of looking chubby or bulky? Are you motivated by being what some people, and this could be the wrong term again, but that stick insect like look, is that what you're striving for? Or I've often heard it said that, you know, someone who's anorexic, they don't realize how thin they look to other people. I don't even know what you look like, but are you a very thin person who people say, you know, you're beginning to get frail?
Well, people have said that to me, but I am currently underweight, and people have said that to me, but other people have then said to me that they're actually jealous of my figure, including some medical staff. The problem is that there is this unconscious kind of idea that people have to be a certain size to have anorexia, and there have been studies that have shown that people to access treatment have had to lose weight to meet that expectation, even though it can affect and be serious and life-threatening at any weight. My current weight, while it would be underweight, I wouldn't be striving for a lower weight. I think for me, because it's been so long-term, it has become habitual. I'm uncomfortable at higher weights, but at my lowest weight, whenever I had to go inpatient, I actually denied that I had anorexia when I was inpatient, and I couldn't understand why I was there because I couldn't see the problem, whereas everybody else could see the problem.
If I saw you in swimwear, would I be able to see your rib cage?
The thing is, I don't really see my body the way other people see it. I would say that currently, because I am underweight, you could tell visually that I am underweight. But again, images of sort of emaciation and things like that aren't necessary to be diagnosed with anorexia.
And that is a very important point, actually. Felicity, I could speak to you for half an hour about this, and I'm sure people who are listening to the program would like to hear more, because listening to a young woman who is coping with it and who's writing her dissertation about it makes you incredibly interesting to those of us who are ignorant of the condition. Just very briefly, Felicity, what are you hoping to achieve with the dissertation?
I'm actually hoping to see about changing the interactions between patients and professionals. I find that because there is this expectation of a lower weight, it is actually preventing people from accessing services. And I think that that's possibly why we have spent since 2011, £8.6 million to send people abroad. And this is on top of the current eating disorder budget. But if it wasn't on top of the eating disorder budget and was taken directly from the £2 million spent per year, it would account for 42% of the entire budget since 2011. We spend so much money sending people abroad. It's a clear indication that there isn't the right services here or access to the right services here in Northern Ireland. And it's why Mark Durkin is right in that we need to have that specialised centre. We probably won't get it. I have spoken to politicians and I have spoken to people who are on the committees. The people on the committee seem to think that there's a possibility of getting it. The politicians such as Simon Hamilton and Arlene Foster, now speaking to them about it, don't seem to think so. They're looking more towards early intervention, which, while early intervention is good, like, it doesn't actually account for what we need, because while for example, with anorexia, 46% of patients will recover fully, 20% remain chronically ill, with 33% improving. That accounts sort of more for like a almost 50-50 of whether or not you recover or remain ill. So while early intervention is key for full recovery, it's not accounting for people who have missed that. And we have specialised centres for cancer and for other issues in Northern Ireland. There's no excuse to not have one for eating disorders when it has the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. Felicity, you're more likely to die from an eating disorder than you are from some forms of cancer.
Felicity, it's seriously, I'm out of time because we're getting very close to the 11 o'clock news, but you would be, make a wonderful subject for a television documentary, because your fluency and expertise about something you're coping with is enlightening. I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for the call, girl. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a young student. Let me speak to David, who's got a point about the eating disorders. David, good morning.
Morning, Frank.
Yes, David, go ahead.
Frank, I think there's a very great need for that facility in Northern Ireland. My wife was the first person in Northern Ireland over 25 years ago to be sent to the Priory for an eating disorder. And as I say, the problem with that there was she had a young son at the time, so the young son had to be looked after by the grandparents. And when she was in the Priory, the only visitor she had was her brother and her uncle, who both lived over in that general direction. So yes, I do think there's a very great need in Northern Ireland for that type of facility.
David, I don't want to pursue a conversation about someone else's health or well-being, even though we've not revealed your identity. But
no.
But did it work? Just yes or no, did it work?
The simple answer to it is that there's no such thing as a cure for an eating disorder. There's a methodology of teaching them how to live with it. But, you know, they won't suddenly go from eating nothing to basically eating the full Sunday dinner type of thing, you know. Sadly, no. At one stage, my wife weighed less than 3.5 stone. She'd been given the last rites a couple of times. And I'd say the damage that was done then sadly took its toll on her. And she passed away this year.
Ah, David, I'm very, 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 very sorry. Very sorry to hear that. You will have an understanding, David, of what other families are going through. And it must be an additional stress for a parent who sees a child coping with an eating disorder.
Yes. Now, on several occasions, she said to me that basically, if someone had took her by the hand, said, come in, sit down, sit there and eat that, I'm going to watch you eating it. She said she probably would have done it. But I think it was because she was allowed to sort of avoid eating. You know, everybody says don't force your children to eat. You know, if they don't want to eat, they don't want to eat out there. But at some stage, when you realise that, you know, this not eating has went from, you know, just a few hours to a few days to a week, you know, that's when it starts to get a bit ridiculous and action needs to be taken fairly quickly.
So the specialist centre that Mark H. Durkin is adding his voice to, you feel that it would be a step in the right direction here?
It definitely would be. I would fully support Mark Durkin for the actions that he's taken. And I hope to God and I hope to pray that a facility like this can be opened in Northern Ireland.
David, thank you. A man obviously knowing exactly what he is talking about from personal family experience. Good morning to you. 90-333-105 077-66-105-105. Frank, the teacher's on the gravy train with the biscuit wheels, says Stephen. I think a lot of us, and I have to add this in as a writer whenever we talk about teaching, so many people, especially the main thrust of those who would make up the bulk of the listenership to a station like this, it's a few years from you've been at school and you tend to have, I suppose, a very dim view of the teacher. The teacher of yesteryear was seen more like a prison warden, weren't they? You know, back when I was in school, the best of teachers, I loved my teachers. I could list a fine bunch of people as individuals, but the structure of teaching back in the day, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s would have been something where a teacher was there to keep control. And sometimes it was darn hard. It was a heck of a task. But they weren't really there primarily to educate. They were there to referee. So as a result, you sometimes have a dim view of teachers. I think especially if you're the wrong side of 40. If you're on the younger side, are you more sympathetic to their cause? Do feel free, 90333105. Just one of the topics this morning, this issue where a specialist centre should be set up for people with eating disorders. A lot of you remarking on that as well, including Tracy. Morning, Tracy.
Good morning, Frank.
And what's your opinion, please?
Well, my story is I had a daughter diagnosed at the age of 10 with an eating disorder. And just listening to David there, I mean, it's tragic. Or, you know, the effect it had on his wife, and it took its toll on her. But you can't force a child to eat when they don't want to eat, and I've been there. So early intervention is definitely the key. My daughter ended up being tube fed for 2 months. And like nobody in this world could have made her eat. Nobody. So definitely early intervention the key, and a specialist eating disorder centre is needed, definitely.
When you saw her being forced to eat, how traumatic was that for you?
Actually, when she was fed through a tube, she was tube fed for 2 months, it was a relief because she was wasting away in front of our eyes. So we knew then she was getting the nutrients.
And you saw it as a mental illness as, as opposed to a physical illness?
Mental, yeah.
And progress, has progress been made?
Yeah, well, we're 3 years down the line, but we live with it every day. It's just how you cope with it, really. I mean, the key for recovery is getting the weight back on, because her mind had gone, really. She just saw us as the enemy, and she thought it was the end of the world if she put weight on. And she didn't weigh herself, but and she didn't count calories. It was just, she just stopped eating. She ate as little as she could get away with eating. And when we thought, oh, she's ate well today, she would have went and made herself sick afterwards, which we weren't aware of.
And this is common. This happens commonly across Northern Ireland.
Yes.
We're somewhat shocked to think that children as young as 10
well, she was diagnosed at the age of 10. She was hospitalised when she was 11. But you can't, the thing is, I know people saying if you make a child sit down and say you must eat that, you cannot force a child to eat if they don't want to eat.
Is it partly down to the pressure of the media, the images that we see, or is that a red herring?
Well, I would have said at the age of 10 she wasn't really aware of social media. She wouldn't have had like Facebook, or she wouldn't have been on social media very much. She's a very intelligent child. She loved reading.
But even the models you see in the magazines,
yeah,
or the stars who are on TV,
yeah,
is any of that to be factored into the discussion, or am I being unfair to
very slim
and trim people?
Yeah, I think that there is an element of that. There's an element of that, but I think it's down to personality. You kind of find that people who develop eating disorders are very controlling, perfectionist people. They want, I mean, I can relate to my daughter. She's a perfectionist. Everything has to be perfect, or it's not worth doing, or she has to be the top in school, or else school's not worthwhile. She's just a very controlling person, and I think this was her way. At that stage, she was P7, so she had the transfer test, so we kind of thought, oh, this is just like a reaction to the stress of the transfer test, but it developed, and it obviously, it got worse.
Yeah, you use the word controlling, and the word that springs to mind for you is a very disciplined,
yes,
almost too disciplined.
Yes, too disciplined. I mean, because she could starve herself, not eat a bite, or eat a quarter of an apple, and then go out and run rings around the garden.
That is a worry, and every parent likes balance, and this is your concern about your child. Hopefully the progress will continue. I can understand, Tracy, why you're joining the politician in
yes,
saying
definitely
that a specialist centre would be a step in the right
yeah
direction.
Well, she was hospitalised for 2 months. Now, the staff in the hospital were amazing. They were fantastic. But they weren't trained in eating disorders, and they weren't trained in meal support. So they didn't know what to say to her at meal times to encourage her to eat. So her meal support was kind of left to us. Now, the Eating Disorders Youth Service, we still attend them, and they're amazing. They're a fantastic group of people, and they know their stuff. But they're kind of restricted. If a child gets to the stage where they need medical intervention, they have to go into hospital. So a specialised centre where they could go would be fantastic.
Okay, another very concerned parent. Tracy, thank you.
The Frank Mitchell phone-in on U105, here for you.
Dirty's got a point about the eating disorders. Morning, Deirdre.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I am very well. What's on your mind?
Well, I just felt prompted to get in touch with you because I work as a mind wellness expert down here in Newcastle and County Down, and I help a lot of people. And when I was listening to the lady talking about her daughter, I didn't hear all of it. But I just felt prompted to get in touch and let people know that with the cutting edge work that's going on at the minute, we are learning more and more about how the mind works. And something like an eating disorder is actually the symptom. It's not actually the cause. So when you kind of skirted around, or she did, around the 11 plus, that would ring a bell for me if I was working with a client like this. I'm not interested in the eating or the not eating. I am interested in what is causing the person to eat or not eat. And very often it's a control thing. Cannot control what else is going on in the world. We cannot control our emotions. So what we do is we decide to take control over what we feel we can, which is food. So we're in charge. So we eat or we don't eat. Does that make sense?
I understand you're basing that on what the lady said about maybe the pressures of the transfer exam. But do you think most people can trace it back to a crisis or to a problem or to an issue? Is it as simple as that? If it was, there's hardly need for a specialist eating disorder centre.
Absolutely. I do believe that that what you're looking at is actually the symptom, and the cause can be traced back there. Because if it was just about food, then, you know, we could all have it.
So it is a form of mental illness that I think most people are agreeing on, but it could be associated with one experience somewhere that's seen as the beginning of the ripple effect.
Yeah, it could be one. I would challenge you there on your description. Mental illness. These are very partially loaded words, and there's a lot of stigma attached to that kind of description. So if I was talking to someone, I would just call it a symptom. And actually,
but why not call it mental illness? Why not call all of these things mental illness, from eating disorders through to death by suicide? Because isn't it surely like a cancer of the mind, and it needs to be addressed the same way as bowel cancer or any heart disease or any other issue that is in keeping with the makeup of our body?
So what I say to my people is anyone comes through my door is a success, and this can really throw them. Because the person who has the eating disorder, the person who has the mental illness, as you describe it, I don't look at them that way. I will say, you are a success. You are successfully producing a result based on your past references. So when we go back and change, not necessarily what happened, but how you hold what happened in the past, we can really make very powerful changes. I have worked with a lot of young people who are, just as this lady had described, a very successful, intelligent child who's reading and successfully achieving GCSEs, A-levels. This is academic success. What I'm talking about is emotional intelligence. And this is where we're kind of going wrong at the minute. But thank God things are changing. Emotional intelligence is the most important thing that we can pay attention to.
There will be people from the medical world, of course, listening to you. You describe yourself, as you've said, as a mind wellness expert and someone who deals with clients or with patients or whatever you like to call them. There'll be people who will see you as a bit of a maverick.
Well, I'm ready. I'm happy to address any questions that anyone would have, because I have been on my own personal journey. I know what it's like. I've survived family suicide. I've survived cancer. I've survived a lot of traumas. And I, Frank, was seeking my own answers. So I have been pretty diligent about finding what works for me. And I now have my own proofs which is my own proof, first of all. And I do know that this is challenging the allopathic model. The medical model, I have been through it myself, having had cancer. And whereas I agree that people are very well-meaning, there's so much new evidence coming up every day about how the mind works that I'm happy to be challenged by people like that, because it will, if they're challenged and it causes them to find out more information, then that's my job done. I'm happy.
Well,
because all I can say, Frank, is that I am getting results. You know, I have people who have come to me with eating disorders, with alcohol issues, with suicidal. I've had, in the last 3 months, I've had about 6 young people, highly, highly intelligent academically, totally ready to pack the whole thing in. We do the work and it all changes. So that's all I can offer as my evidence.
Well, you know, I appreciate you listening to the programme and giving us a call on what is a very relevant topic. And from having the conversation with you and making reference indeed to your name as Deirdre, I've worked out that it is Deirdre Maguire that I'm actually speaking to. And, you know, I appreciate your input, Deirdre. I don't think everyone's going to agree with you on it, but I am aware of the angle that you do take when it comes to the wellness of the mind. And I suppose people are open to guidance from whichever quarter.
Absolutely. If it causes you to challenge, if what I say challenges your thinking, then that's good. Because I too in my own life have been, fallen into what I call nowadays the trap of the tramp. We just take all this information in and we become conditioned. And we believe that the 11 plus is the most important thing in the world. We believe that, you know, get your academic... I was that soldier. Get your, you know, academic qualification and then you'll be good to go. And if that was the case, Frank, then, you know the guys that are in prison, they go to prison and... you know, they study for 3 or 4 years and they produce an academic result. They get their degrees, they get everything else. So if academia was the most important thing, then why aren't we all just, those that have achieved academic results, why isn't our life perfect?
Okay, a question that I'm going to leave hanging there. Is this relevant to what we're talking about? Some would say absolutely. We're putting ourselves and our young people under far too much pressure. Or do we need goals? Do we need targets to aim for? I appreciate the call, Deirdre. Thank you very much indeed. Interesting to see what people think when you hear it from that angle, not coming from the traditional medical background, is the writer, Deirdre Maguire.